listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Whoops, good morning. Thank you for joining us. Today is Wednesday, 5 May 15, 2024, and we have a beautiful day in LA. Actually, it's a little overcast like it has been, but we get like this marine layer here that, you know, I mean, you go to the beach and there's no sun. So the other day, you know, on my birthday, I took my wife to the beach. We go there, it's like 65 degrees and freezing wind, you know. So, we came back and, it wasn't that great, actually. I'm excited to have a guest today in the studio, Theo Penglis. Thank you for joining us, Theo.
Thank you.
And Theo is very famous. He's been on a lot of things, and mainly people know you from Days of Our Lives, right?
True.
And you've been on there for how many years?
On and off for 42 years.
42 years?
Yeah.
Wow. It's unbelievable how long the show has been going.
I've been in a lot of kitchens in my life.
Yeah, a lot of kitchens.
I'm sure that's what they're watching. You know, they're making dinner for the evening, the wives.
Yeah.
Occasionally, they'll save it in the evening, especially for male people who like to watch soaps, but basically in the closet.
You know, yeah.
They don't like to admit.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been a wonderful run.
Yeah.
But it gave me the opportunity to take a lot of journeys in my life.
Right.
So,
and we'll find out about them all and stuff. I just want to let people know you have a new book, and we'll talk about that. You're going to promote it. You're going to have a book signing, right?
Yes.
On the 22nd?
Yes, at the Grove, at Barnes & Noble.
Right, which is a great place there to do this.
Yeah, it is.
Most of the books are being signed there, you know, so
yeah.
I like that area. It's really nice, you know.
It's nice. It's safe.
Yeah, yeah. You know, place to hang out with the family.
Yeah, especially Christmas. Christmas is a lovely time to go there.
They make it very nice,
I know. And good restaurants.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. And people are very – I see that the reason I say it's safe is because I see a lot of parents bring their children.
Mm-hmm.
So they feel like this is a safe environment. And
it's a nice family place. For
yeah,
sure.
It is, yeah. A lot of Jewish, in a Jewish area, so you see a lot of Jewish children running around. And
right.
But it's nice. It's you don't see that very often in LA.
Yeah, no, you don't.
We're too busy in cars.
Yeah, exactly. People don't walk that much. This is sort of like our Rockefeller Center, you know, where people just hang out and stuff and the holidays and things like that.
Except there's no tall buildings.
No tall.
It was a marketplace, right?
Yeah, actually, it's next to the farmer's market.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful place to go in L.A. if you're ever here. So let's find out a little bit about you. We were talking a little bit. You were born in Greece, right?
No, I was born in Australia.
Oh, you were born in Australia.
Yeah.
But your parents are from?
Both parents are from an island called Gastelorizo, which is one of the Dodecanese Islands.
Uh-huh.
They lived in the 30s, but the island, I think in history, in ancient history, it was part of Turkey. And through earthquakes, that it separated. And now, of course, it's a Greek island, but it's really too close to Turkey.
Yeah. Turkey and Greece were always fighting over land and stuff, right?
Well, I don't think it was the Greeks that were fighting. It was
the Turks.
The Turks invading and occupy us for 350 years.
Yeah, with the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, the Ottoman Empire. I mean, as far as Egypt, they were powerful, but brutal empire.
Right.
Although when you go to Turkey, I think the people are wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never been, but I heard it's beautiful there, huh?
I was there last year.
Yeah.
I just love Turkey. I've been there quite a few times.
Mm.
I think the Greeks, the Turks are nicer than the Greeks. The Greeks have a kind of an arrogance. But the Turks are really very down-to-earth people.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of history.
Yeah,
the history
a lot of
is
culture.
Not theirs. Yes, the history, you know, I mean, you look at countries like Greece that have their own culture. Turkey has its own culture, but its history, really, except since the 16th century, is all Greek and Roman.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, that's where we got Constantine and the beautiful Hagia Sophia, which is now a mosque, but yeah, that's how it
is. What are you going to do, you know?
What do you do? Leaders, you know, they don't represent the people.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think Putin represents Russia.
Yeah, no, not at all. You know. No. And the government in Turkey is not much better, you know. But what are you going to do, you know? We're not going to get into politics right now. I mean, the world right now is like on fire, you know?
Isn't it interesting? Well, you know, you think, how did previous histories and how did they resolve themselves?
Right.
I don't think there was one of the worst, I think, had to be the Second World War.
Right.
And the First World War was terrible as well. So right. We had three.
And, you know, there were, like, bad times. People talk about hard times right now, but remember when, way back when, I mean, you can't remember this, but in history, people would be invaded, you know, and villages would be pillaged and raped and murdered and all this stuff. And life, I think, was much harder. You know, there was a lot of poverty and things like that. So
you see that in Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah. But, I know. You know what I mean? I know, so yeah.
I don't know why they have to be so brutal.
Yeah. I don't know. Mankind is sometimes you wonder, you know. I mean, we can do men. Yeah.
Have you seen a woman leader say, let's go to war, except maybe in Britain?
I don't see that very often. No, You're right.
They're bloody egos.
Yeah. And they're too violent, you know. Too much violence going on. I don't know, man. They don't know how to get along, man, you know.
Some of these leaders that provoke wars,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to sit down and find out who they are.
Yeah.
Because they never reveal that.
Uh-huh.
It's just a facade. But what is really going on with them psychologically?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they disturbed people? I mean, certainly Hitler was.
Right.
You know, so even today, you know, in America, I mean, you look at some of the behavior.
I think it's power, right? People are power hungry.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's all about money.
Yeah.
I don't know why people... I mean, they can't take it with them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when you're getting old and someone says, well, you have to buy a house. And I said, well, what for? Yeah. I mean, I have a house, but, you know, when I go to Australia, my brother says to me, well, you come here and buy a house. I said, I don't want to buy a house now.
Yeah.
Well, why wouldn't you want to buy it? I said, well, what am I going to do with it? I mean, I'll rent and I can travel whenever I want.
Right. How many houses do you need?
How many houses? And that's the problem. It's like people who hoard jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something to give them security.
Right.
You know, and you notice that most of the men that have a lot of money are not particularly pretty.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like they get their women.
Yeah.
Or whatever their tastes are, and they pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the... I mean, look at the studio system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so...
And the old men that get very young women and stuff, that's all money and stuff, you know?
And I mean, ego.
And fame, you know? And,
ego.
Yeah.
It's empty.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You know, you take that away, there's nothing there. So you've got to fill it up.
Yeah.
I'd hate to be there. That's why I like monasteries.
Yeah.
I understand why men become monks. You know, all they do basically is pray all day, but, you know, they don't have to prove anything.
They have a connection
to their higher self and to God, whoever that may be to them. And, you know, so I've been... Even across Sinai Desert, you know, I've been to St. Catherine's Monastery 3 times.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yes.
That's a beautiful place there. Oh, I've only heard of it.
And climb Sinai.
Yeah.
In Greece, there's a monastery area in the peninsula in the northern part of Greece called Mount Athos.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Greek, it's Agios Oros. And so I spent time there. I went to the first monastery in Egypt that created the monasticism in life. And that was St. Andrew's.
Right.
And that was quite something. I traveled 3 hours into the desert. But there's something gratifying when you come out of a place where you have silence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something about where, you know, the soul, I mean, yourself, your core of yourself, needs quietness.
Yeah.
You know, in order to think and to align yourself with who you are and what you're connected to.
You got to be in peace with yourself, you know?
Yes, and that's a lifelong...
Yeah, journey.
That's a lifelong journey because there's always going to be some son of a bitch that's going to drive somewhere and you know, create chaos to you.
Yeah.
I mean, we just have to turn on the television and see what's going on with Trump and you going, myself, how much more chaos can you... I mean, they thrive on it, you know? I'd like to have talked to his parents.
Yeah.
So what the hell were you thinking?
I know, man. I know. He's a very interesting person.
No, I don't think of him as being interesting.
No?
No, I just think he's chaotic.
Mm.
He's just, he tries to be interesting. He's not.
Yeah.
But he's like a barker in a circus.
Mm.
You know, he's always making noise to get attention.
Right.
I'm more interested in the people who are quiet because to me that means they're centered. and they're aligned with what's going on, especially leaders of the world.
Mm.
I'm not saying, you know, who I'm going with, but Biden has, you know, people criticize him because he's not a Barker.
Mm.
You know, he's a man with dignity, integrity, and, you know, his decisions are trying to help the circumstances. But, you know, we're also quick to judge.
Yeah.
Just like we're doing, you know, with, I mean, it's just terrible what's going on in the Middle East, you know.
Yeah.
What's
yeah.
going on with the Palestinians and
yeah.
and what happened to the Jewish people in the beginnings of this war. But
yeah. I know. It's too much, you know, too much going on. But going back to you, so you were born in Australia, right?
Yes.
What city in Australia?
Sydney.
In Sydney?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So your parents are from Greece, but they moved to Australia?
Yes. An uncle of mine went to Australia and became a millionaire in the northern part of Australia. So they thought, uh-huh. oh, let's go, you know, uh-huh. because let's face it, Greece was a poor country.
Right.
Great in history, but poor in as far as currency.
Right.
And they went, and my father had a hard time, but I couldn't stand the way life was, he was being treated or the way he treated himself.
Mm.
And a lot of those men in first generation drank a lot, played cards a lot, gambled.
Right.
And
lots of ouzo and stuff, right?
Yeah, and also they weren't nice to the wives in those yeah. times because a lot of the marriages were arranged.
Right.
So, but, you know, eventually they got, you know, when my parents died, they lived together. Within 4 days apart, they died.
Really?
So wow. I always thought, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Why they chose to leave the same. And yeah. in the hospital where my mother was in her final stages, my father had a heart attack. She didn't know, and he died.
Really?
And so my mother kept asking, where's your father? Why hasn't he come to visit me? You know, mm-hmm. and he says, oh, he's very tired. And one night my sister was giving my mother some water, and then my mother looked up to the ceiling, and she called my father's name, and she was gone. So I thought to myself, I wonder if he came for her.
Yeah.
At that moment, she
just looked. So they fell ill, both of them, at the same time?
Yeah, he had a heart condition and she had cancer.
Mm, wow.
Yeah, so she died at 77, he was 84.
Wow.
But in the end, you know what was great about success?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it permeates other things, people, families. It also makes some people upset
yeah.
when you have yeah. success.
It
was kind of nice. I was one of the first Greek boys that left Australia uh-huh. and went to New York, and that was not an easy time. So the first 8 years, I just studied.
How old were you when you moved to New York?
21.
Really? And you were on your own at that time?
Yes, I had $180 in my pocket.
Wow.
I got a free trip with the Ballet Folklorico of Mexico, who in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Amelia Hernandez was the head of the ballet company, and she thought I looked like her son, and she says, why don't you come to Mexico? I was at a party, uh-huh. and I said, to Mexico for? No, it won't cost you anything. Just come on a chartered flight. So I went to my parents, and they said, no. You've got two sisters that have to get married first. So my sisters had to get married first, and I uh-huh. thought, no, I'm going to rebel. And I left, and I, you know, it was tough the first, because, you know, the 20s, are the years you put seeds, plant seeds
right.
of who you're going to become.
Right.
And I planted a lot of seeds.
Yeah.
But the beauty of it all was that the people that crossed my path were winners, were great successes in the field. And I used to go to some of their houses because I was pretty. So I look good at the table at the time. Do you know mm-hmm, what I mean?
Yeah.
It was that type of thing. Oh, bring him up. Bring somebody pretty at the table so everybody, the women can flirt with him and feel happy.
Right.
And the men would get upset. Like one man looked at me one time, a big producer, and he said, do you know why I don't like you? I said, no, why? He says, because you remind me of the kind of guy my wife would have loved to have married and ended up with me. And I went, oh, well that's
what
nice.
Do you say to that, right?
I just said, well, shall we continue with the backgammon? he was Jimmy, he became a good friend, but oh my God, in the beginning. So, you know, when you're young and pretty,
yeah,
you can be a threat.
That's true. And,
you know, even if you don't have success or money.
Right.
But if I told you who invited me to their houses in my 20s, it was
really?
Quite extraordinary.
Wow.
Yeah.
So now when you came, did you go to Mexico first?
Because yes.
that's where you were.
I went to Mexico
invited,
City.
Right.
And I got to meet the Ballet Folklorico, which uh-huh. I loved. And then I saw its culture. I remember going to Tzitzin Itza and Merida and Uxmal. I mean, they were just such amazing history. It's just hard to believe today the kind of brutality.
Yeah.
But then their history was brutal.
Right.
You know, their sacrifices and the way they decapitated people.
Right.
But yes, and then from there I went to New York. And that was not easy.
Right. Now, what were you doing at the time as far as profession?
In Australia, I was a diplomat. I was an immigration official.
Mm-hmm.
And from the time I was 18 to I was 21, I would meet immigrants. I would go on to the launch at 5 in the morning. Car would pick me up. So that always made my mother very proud because her son had a car picking him up at 18.
Yeah.
And I would wear my tie and my shirt. And she would just look and she says, there he goes, my gentleman with pennies in his pocket. And so I would go there to the launch and then we'd get to the ship. And then they throw the ladder down and we climb up as the ship is moving slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would interview up to 500 Greek women coming on an assisted passage because we were short of women in Australia at the time. So I had a great job, and then I was in operations, and I did some good work. I also exposed some, because a lot of people would come to me when they'd sit down and they would put money under my file.
Wow.
And they would say, I hear if I give you some money, you will push my application through faster. I mean, can you imagine doing it here
going
to the DMV and saying, here you are, can you get my thing through first?
And
I would go to my boss, who was quite Anglo, and I'd go to him, I said, excuse me, sir, but I said, the man I'm interviewing just put money under my file. He says, give it to me, son, I'll take care of it. He put the money in his pocket.
Yeah.
Nobody ever saw it again. And then I remembered they had yachts, and I thought, how do they have yachts?
Yeah.
With that kind of salary.
Right.
So I reported it. And then I didn't want to work there anymore. Yeah, yeah, I reported it. I exposed them, and I got graded up quite fast. And they said to me, so congratulations, you're getting a high grade. And I said, oh, that's nice. Is it more money? He says, oh, yes. And then I said, he said, so congratulations. And I said, oh, okay, thank you. He says, you are the first Greek who's worked here that didn't go to prison.
Well,
because everybody was taking money under the table.
Was thinking, whoa.
I couldn't, you know, when you have parents, immigrants, who come to a country with very little, you get to understand the struggles and what your mother puts on the table,
right?
And how your father comes home exhausted and not happy. And you remember those growing up. And so you see another immigrant and it affects you when they think,
right?
You know, I said, listen, I will put it as fast as I could, but know that you're going to be legal in the end of it. It will pass.
Right.
So I confirmed it for them and made them feel okay. So I would say to them up front, please, if the thought of in your mind comes that you think you're going to pay me off, please keep your money in your pocket because they're watching.
Wow. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So then you got that offer. You came to Mexico City. Then you moved to the States.
Yes, I moved to New York.
Uh-huh.
I stayed with one person I knew who after 3 weeks said, you have to go find your own place.
Yeah.
And I was really scared. And I thought, what am I going to do with $180?
Yeah.
And
was it easy to get a visa at the time for you?
No, I was just as a tourist.
Yeah.
And I went, I remember walking on 33rd Street and 2nd Avenue, and I was very upset. I felt lost. I thought, I can't go home because I look like a loser. And so as I was walking by, these two guys were talking to each other. And one said, listen, I'll leave you the stereo and I'll leave you a television set if you take it for $130. I said, I'll take it. And so I had $50 left.
Really?
So it meant
uh-huh.
at least I had it for a month. So I checked with the Australian mission to the UN.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a job there because I was in a good position in Australia. So I got a job there for a year working with the secretary.
Yeah.
And not a lot of money. I mean, one of the things, though, was I used to feed myself. I used to put a tin of ravioli on the stove at the mission So and while I would close my door and I would have canned ravioli for my dinner or for my lunch, and sometimes 2-3 times a week, and then I would maybe have a sandwich or an apple or something. Mm-hmm. But I swore in my life I would never, ever have ravioli again. Every time I see ravioli, I think, oh, no, I don't think so.
Those times,
no, yeah. I don't.
So you've come a long way, obviously. After that, what happened after you worked at the mission?
I went into I called up a friend. It was James Goldie, and he said he looked at me. I met him. He was Scottish, wealthy as hell, mm-hmm. and he lived next to an actress called Catherine Hepburn. And he said to me, "Are you looking for a job?" I said, "Why? Do you have one?" Uh-huh. And he said, "Because after the UN, you know, I after a year, that was it." And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "I'll pay you $75 a week as an apprentice. Do you know history?" And I said, "Yeah, I know my British history. I know mm-hmm. my Greek history, and I know my Roman history." Right. I didn't know Chinese history. So they had the best collection of Southeast Asian sculpture in America, mm-hmm. English 18th century furniture. And so for the next few years, I studied art. And it was amazing what it did for me, because it made me appreciate not just history, but how you respect things that have lasted this long.
Right.
How you don't put anything hot on a table. How you don't put anything that moist under a glass on the table because it stains. Yeah. And so I had a tough boss.
Uh-huh.
But I had an extraordinary experience one day while he was, because he was very arrogant. Mm. And he went to have lunch with an actress called Claudette Colbert. Uh-huh. And when he came back, he said, "I'm going to do this, this, is that, and I'll be back in an hour." I said, "Okay." So I'm sitting there feeling sorry for myself, because I thought, where am I going to go with this? This is not a career. And then the next thing is, there's a knock on the door, and it's Jacqueline Kennedy.
What? Wow.
I open the door, and she's there with two bodyguards.
Uh-huh.
And she says, I haven't got an appointment, but can I come in to the gallery and see the collection?" I said, "Absolutely."
Wow.
And then I asked if she wanted tea. And then I had tea made for her. And we sat for an hour in the gallery talking about the art. I knew every piece and the history about every piece. And then she left. And then an hour later, my boss came and said, "Did anybody important come in while I was out?" I said, "Yes, Jacqueline Kennedy." He went, sure. He went up the stairs and closed the door. And 3 weeks later, she called. She wanted to buy a piece that I showed her.
Whoa.
And he tried to say to me, "Oh, well, you know, I'm the owner of the gallery. How do you do? I'm uh-huh. Robert Ellsworth." And he said, "No, I speak to Teo." So here I was at 21. I sold a piece to Jacqueline Kennedy and had tea with her.
What year was it? Do you remember approximately?
In the early 70s. Yeah. And also, 3 months later, she married Onassis, I think.
Yeah. So that was early 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, it was a good beginning.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I always believe that life will show you where you're going mm-hmm. by what it presents in front of you and mm-hmm. how you treat it and where you take it.
The opportunities.
Yes. And from there, I met a director, Greek director called Milton Katsalas. Mm-hmm. And I spent 40 years with him.
Wow.
I became his assistant for 12 years.
Uh-huh.
He was the assistant when he was younger with Elie Kazan,
uh-huh.
who was one of the great directors of the 40s and the 50s.
Right. 12 years you worked with him?
As an assistant,
As an assistant?
Yeah. Wow. So I learned to direct with him.
Yeah.
And but I learned about administration, how to complete everything that's been asked for. And then after a while, I was very intuitive. I always knew what he was going to want the next day. Mm-hmm. And he taught me one thing. He says, when you write a whole list of things on the page, he said, then when you finish that day, rip that page off and put the stuff that hasn't been completed on a new page mm-hmm. because in the mind, it's fresh. Right. And you won't repeat it, because when you look at things that you've already done, you stop and your mind is going, did I finish that? That he taught me about that. He taught me about discipline. He taught me about respect. He taught me about a lot of things. Right. And that's when I learned to cook.
Yeah. So now you're very fortunate. I mean, you've been around people that actually were inspiring to you. You could learn from them.
You know?
Yeah.
And how do you do that?
Yeah. I know. Well, you've got to be open, you know. And
you've got to be curious. Open, and you've got to know the person that's crossing your path. Mm-hmm. Are they a winner? Are they a loser? Mm-hmm. Are they there pretending? So it's not just listening. It's also you sharpen your tools, your intuition.
Right.
And I learned that when I studied an archaeologist called Onyx Schliemann, who found Troy and Mycenae and all these wonderful treasures. And he sharpened, the reason he became successful in life is because he sharpened his tools. Mm. And that was his intuition. So that when somebody came up to him, he wasn't anybody's fool.
I see.
You know, because people will reveal themselves in the beginning.
Yeah, that's
the trouble is we don't want to listen because we want something. Yeah. The ego.
So we see something else.
Yeah, we see something else, you know. I mean, I don't think you'd meet Putin and think, oh, he's a nice man. Right. I'd like to spend some more time with him. Right. I mean, he's an extreme. But, you know, people do cross your paths. And some are only there to teach you a lesson, to show you something you didn't know, or to celebrate with you.
Right.
And so then I went into fashion.
Okay.
While I was studying with Milton. And I learned about clothing. I uh-huh. learned about how to carry a suit. Did I know that in those 20s that all this education I was having was going to be part of who I became in life? The clothes as an actor, to know how to dress, you know.
Right.
I think one of the things that made me successful on the show, on Days of Our Lives, was because of fashion. I mean, you understood fashion, didn't I?
Yeah.
Dressed him, in a sense, accordingly. So that once I put the shoes on, it gave me the walk. Once I put the suit on,
uh-huh.
it gave me the attitude.
You feel like someone else, someone... More.
Not someone else. I feel like I have brought up is another part of myself.
I see.
It's all part of you.
Right.
A lot of people don't understand or don't tap into those areas of self, so they never really get a complete idea of who they are.
That's true.
And that through all that, all those machinations through life in my 20s, it gave me a platform of where to stand.
Right.
And so I remember... I was going to class, there was a substitute teacher, and I was wearing this very expensive suit that came from where I was working in Melodondre. Mm-hmm. And Melodondre did the clothes for Godfather, and so he was quite famous in right. his day. And my teacher, when I finished, he goes, you know, that was good work, but I get a feeling from you that you're lazy and you take things for granted. I have a feeling you've been pampered in your life and spoiled. And yeah. I looked at him and I said, why? Because of this expensive suit? It's the only one I have.
Yeah.
What you're seeing is how I was brought up.
Right.
You're seeing my genes. I'm not lazy. I came from Australia with $180 in my pocket.
Yeah.
What you're seeing on me is success.
Right.
And so people would miss, especially when you were young, they thought, oh, he must come from money.
Right.
But I gave that illusion, even though I wasn't. Rich, I gave the illusion that, you know, it's, you know, you want to walk into a room and look like a success. You don't
That's
want to
look
true. Like you're desperate on your last
right
bite of food.
Wow. Sorry, I'm just a little distracted here, but...
was it something I said?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's just that the internet here, I don't know what it is. Oh, they're supposed to come fix it, you know, but it's giving me a little trouble. But
oh, that's okay.
But that's okay. So you got into the fashion and you've become this well-dressed man and everything. Yeah. How did you get into acting now? What was the step
there? A Greek actor who was played the prince in The Unsinkable Molly Brown with Debbie Reynolds.
Debbie Reynolds.
Yes.
I used to work for her, actually. She was a sweetheart.
Yeah. Oh, I always loved her.
Yeah.
Vasily Lambrinos, his name was.
Mm-hmm.
And he met me at a party. He said, you should be an actor. And I said, no. He says, well, come to this class and see if you like it, you know. So it was that class that really gave me the permission. The teacher, because she said to me, I was so awful as an actor. She said, you're not an actor. And so I had a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
I was basically in the beginning building my facade, not inside. I was building the outside.
The look. More.
Yes. Yeah. More. And then I had to go to spiritual counseling because I had a lot of problems.
Really?
Yeah. My father was not a great man when it came to raising me. He was rather brutal. And I think part of his failures in life was being imposed on me because he thought I was going to fail as well. And I was his eldest son. But, you know, the wonderful thing about it all is when I went back home, he opened his arms up to me and was crying. I'd never seen him cry. And he called me his Levendi, which means my warrior, and hugged me because I just came off a talk show. I hosted a talk show in Australia. I went over to do Mission Impossible over there. And that gave my father great prestige, going to the Greek club. You know, what's he going to do?
Wow, yeah.
He couldn't go to the club because he thought that I was going to shame the family because I left early, and they were saying, why would he leave and live in that country? He's either hustling or he's with hookers or drugs. You know? And I'm thinking, did you ever see me that way?
That's terrible.
Yeah. So he believed it because what was he going to believe? I hadn't been home in 6 years, and I swore that I wouldn't go home until something about me went beyond them, that I had become success or was going towards that.
Right.
And so once I got into the acting, the director, Milton Katselis, who had won a Tony and was really quite extraordinary, said to me, I want you to come with me to California, and we're going to open a school. So I went with him, and we opened the Beverly Hills Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think about the actors that came through there, some really wonderful, wonderful actors. And so I had to meet the actors and book them to come into class. I had to take the money. I had to book the scenes. I had to close the workshop. I had to open the workshop. And I would also have to study and also do scenes in the class. So I went to him one day. I said, you know, this is not enough money. You're paying me. He goes, what? Imagine telling a Greek. I said, you're not paying me enough for what I'm doing. And I said, look how much money I'm making for you. I should get a percentage.
Yeah.
I didn't know about those things. And he just looked at me. And I started to find out that I had a mouth on me. It got me into trouble at times because I was straightforward.
Right.
When someone was bullshitting, I would say, you know, cut the crap.
Right.
And let's get to the point. I mean, you know, I had a few problems in the beginning on Days of Our Lives, and they wanted in the beginning to fire me because I was difficult, because I had an opinion, and also because my accent, when I cut through the bullshit, it hits you. I did a communication course where you learn how to say no to somebody and hit them on the nose with it, because a lot of people will say no, but they're apologizing in their tone. How do you say no and make sure the person gets it the first time? And then you repeat it if they don't.
Right.
So I learned about communication. And so, you know, the class was phenomenal for me. It taught me everything about life. And then I got Days of Our Lives. I went to New York, did a play in New York. Out of that came three films. And then I went to Los Angeles and went to the Geffen Theater and did a play called Play with Fire. And then they called me to audition for Charlton Heston and Vanessa Redgrave in Man for All Seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the director, O'Brien, he had won three Tonys. And I went back for the third and final, went really well. I noticed there was nobody else in the room, no other actors. And then they wanted me to meet Charlton Heston.
Wow.
And I have to say, he was such a gent. He was an actor's actor. He was my hero from Ben Hur and El Cid. Yeah. You know, I just loved his movies, and he was always heroic.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I did his monologue together, and we did the scene, and he just said to me, "That was lovely. That was just so simple. I love your acting because you know how to communicate without, because you're young in the scene, because the character was in his 20s, you know how to communicate, probably because what it taught me was all those lessons I had, and ongoing to, taught me that getting to the truth, getting to simplicity, takes a lot of work. I mean, you know, if you've made a soup, well, and you're serving it, all that, the ingredients in there took time. So that when it's finished, it looks simple.
Right.
When you present it. So is in life. You go and that's how simplicity arrived. So I left and I thought, oh, I've got this. And then they called me up and they said John Glover from New York, who'd won a Tony, wanted to play the part.
Mm-hmm.
So they offered me the understudy. And I got furious. No, because I'd been going backwards and forwards for over a month. And then they called me in for Altered States with Ken Russell directing and Bill Hurt.
Oh, wow.
And so I took that instead.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, so were you in Altered States?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember that movie. It was pretty
Yeah, powerful. I played Echeverria, who was his teacher, basically, when they went down into Mexico.
Yeah.
And where he had all the hallucinations.
Uh-huh.
And that was quite something. And yeah. Wouldn't you know it, 20 years later, I'm hosting a talk show in Australia for a week. They asked me, and I flew me over, and I'm hosting this talk show. And my first guest is Ken Russell.
Mm-hmm.
And here I was, you know, I was just an actor with him. Now he was directing Madame Butterfly in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Teo, how wonderful it is to see you. And then we start talking about, and he was the bastard of bastards.
Yeah.
They don't come any worse than that.
Right.
I mean, he's gone now, but oh my God. You know, yeah. He drank too much.
Yeah.
And, but he was a great artist.
Yeah.
And he, you know, when we first worked together, he put his arm around me and he says, you know, for an Australian, I hate Australian accents. You really hit it on the mark there mm-hmm. with the character.
Right.
And so we got along pretty well. But the interview was fantastic.
Mm.
And so and I learned to do interviews with people. And then I had Dame Edna. Do you know Dame Edna?
No.
You've never heard of Dame Edna?
No.
Oh, my God, if he was alive, he'd slap you. she'd slap you. Because he was the most famous drag, a straight man,
uh-huh.
but one of the cleverest, wittiest men ever. Mm. And I became his best man. He was a guest on the talk show. I became his best man on his second marriage.
Yeah,
he just died this past year, sadly. I mean, I don't know. It took a while for the Americans to understand his humor, but he was fantastic.
Right. You know, I want to continue talking about your career because you've done so much, but we're running out of time, and I want to get to your book.
Yes.
So, how did the book come about? What's the name of the book?
Seducing Celebrities, One Meal at a Time.
Okay. Sounds great.
It is. I love the book. I thought it came out pretty well, actually.
Yeah.
I mean,
what made you want to write this book?
I was in Cuba.
Uh-huh.
In Havana, and I went to a restaurant called La Guarita.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it means the cockroach.
Is it cockroach cucaracha or something?
Yeah, but that's what someone told me. But maybe it's really about shrimp,
uh-huh.
the shrimp. Anyway, so I went there and I saw on its wall, the restaurant, I saw these photographs of all these celebrities that went there because it was a famous restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at them and they've got the dishes in front of them that they had ordered. And I thought, oh, my God, they were seduced. I thought the word seduced. And then I left and I came through immigration and they said to me, what were you doing in Cuba?
Oh, God.
Yeah. And I looked at him and I said, oh, I always wanted to go to a place that didn't know God. Mm. And they went, what? They're looking at me like, are you kidding me? And then I said to them, are you questioning my religious beliefs? And they said, no. I said, oh, good. Well, I said, I was there really to I'm writing a new book. I wasn't at the time, but I came out, and then my manager called me and said, I just got an order for you to do a cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
I said, because I hear you cook a lot. And I went, a cookbook? I don't write anything down. It all comes out of my head. I open the fridge door, and I go, okay, what am I going to eat? And then he says, well, can you do it? And they want it in 6 months. So...
Yeah. Did they know you cooked good? I mean, did they
Well, it got around because I had dinner parties.
I see, okay.
You know, people get... There's not many people have dinner parties anymore.
No, not anymore. No, and you're the one that cooked, too.
Yeah.
So it's not like you ordered it and had catering or something done.
No, and it's like some people, you go in their houses, there's no smell. I'm thinking, right. What did they cook? And then I grew up suddenly because I realized they didn't cook it.
Yeah.
Their mothers, or they bought it somewhere and they brought it in and they're heating it up.
Exactly.
So when you come into my house, there's an aroma. And then there's all these flowers and there's this atmosphere, the lighting inside and out. There's music playing.
Uh-huh.
And there's this table that I call my watering hole that people come around. And the great conversations we've had, because most of my friends, you know, and they're interesting. Those who are not don't last very long. But but I remember I went into my head and I thought, how did I cook that? And I went through everything in my head.
Mm.
And I remember the publisher said, do these recipes work? I said, I don't know. I said, they did when I made them. You know, it was in the measurements. And then so I did a whole variety of them. And I thought, well, who are the people I met in my life?
Mm.
Who have I cooked for? You know, Doris Roberts, Omar Sharif. I've cooked for those people. I thought, I met Jacqueline Kennedy. I met George Clooney. I met Charlton Heston. So the idea popped in. I said to them, how about seducing celebrities? Because let's face it, what is food? It's a seduction. It's the magic of the universe that rewards us.
It's interesting because people view food in so many different things, you know. And it's amazing you thinking about it as seduction because it makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so by doing that, because let's face it, you don't always want to cook. And then when you think you've got 10 people coming for dinner, it's a lot of work.
That's a lot of work.
You know, the shopping is a lot of work.
Yeah, yeah.
Carting it out of the car. And I mean, I don't have the servants. You know, I take them up myself.
Yeah.
But I tell you, I've never had anybody leave my house disgruntled or anything. I always have a good atmosphere. Food's always turned out well because you have to love doing it and you have to love the people who you're serving. Occasionally, you'll get somebody who says, I can't eat that. I mean, I remember the time we used to go to people's homes and they would serve you and you ate what they gave you.
Exactly.
Now it's like a bloody restaurant. They come in and they're thinking, oh, what else do you have? You know, would you like a menu?
Yeah.
You know, so I had to develop things just in case that happened. It happened a few times of where I would have vegetarian food.
I see.
That I would do, like shiitake mushrooms and truffle oil and pasta and things like that. And basil and mint and heirloom tomatoes and fresh peas and pine nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make a great recipe. And then put some Parmesan cheese on it. It's a fantastic.
Mm.
So I'm going to cook that. I'm doing next week. I'm going to be doing a show called Lifestyles. Mm-hmm. So I have to cook there. And I think I'm going to do that recipe because to me, it's always the recipe to go in case some blunder is there. So I have, you never know, because I let somebody cook in my house one time and he burnt everything.
Really? Wow.
And so I had to have something else.
Yeah. No, that's interesting, you know. So how do you come up with the recipes? You just kind of start experimenting?
Remember I said to you in the early part of the interview is that you sharpen your tools.
Right.
Well, sharpening your tools is also the smell. The understanding of what ingredients do when they come together.
Mm.
It's just something I know intuitively. It's, you know, when you go into Chinese restaurants, there's a certain, not that it's all good for you, but there is a certain smell to it. So to me, it's knowing that, let's face it, everything I've done, I've never had a bad meal.
Mm-hmm.
But I've improved on it.
Yeah.
Like I know that, you know, if you're doing rack of lamb or if you're doing fish and you put it on a rack, you must have water underneath. Because what the water does when you're broiling something, the water will moisten the fish or the meat while the broiler is burning it on top and crisp, making it crisp.
I see.
And so, and the ingredients you put on the lamb, you know. Those tricks you learn, you know. And also that when I make a soup, I don't make a soup unless I have an organic chicken. And that chicken I will cook for 2 hours and get all the juices out of it, and that will be the base for the broth.
Mm.
So everything's from scratch. I don't do packaged stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Good for you. You know, I mean, it sounds good. How many recipes do you have in the book?
75.
75?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
When did you have time to develop all this? I mean, wow.
Well.
Because you've been busy in your career, too, yeah. You know?
Well, I cooked a pizza for myself.
Uh-huh.
I would rarely go out for dinner because, firstly, you know, you don't know what they've put in it.
That's true.
And sometimes foods are, especially Asian foods, are too much salt.
Mm.
And so I like things, you know, natural. I don't like things excessive.
Right.
You know, the old saying in Greece.
Yeah.
That I learned from Milton is nothing in excess and know thyself.
Yeah.
Those two elements. And so the same with food. You know yourself. That's what you develop yourself as you're getting older. And nothing in excess. And that applies to food as well.
Wow. Very interesting. Mm. So you have obviously meat, meals with meat, fish, chicken, yeah. Things like that. But you also have vegan and vegetarian stuff in there?
Yeah. Last night I did a lentil soup with shiitake mushrooms.
Oh, wow. I love both. I can imagine together it would be
amazing. It's wonderful because the shiitake, almost, if you cut them thick,
mm-hmm.
they become almost like a piece of meat, you know?
Yeah.
I love the texture when you bite into it.
Yeah,
I put some carrots, some celery, some chard, because mm-hmm. the chard gives it color.
Mm-hmm.
So also it must look appealing. Otherwise,
yeah,
you know,
of course.
Lentil soup, you know, just is brown.
Uh-huh.
So you add these other qualities to them. And so I've got that soup for 3 days and a salad and all vegetables with it.
Yeah.
So that's what I did last night. I did Brussels sprouts and broccoli.
Wow.
So that gives me the greens and the nutrition of the soup.
Yeah, amazing. And it takes a lot of patience too, right? I mean, to come up with
I wouldn't say patience, lot of enjoyment.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yes, you'd have to change the concept.
That's true.
You know, if you say, oh, this is going to be difficult, it's like me having to go to the DMV tomorrow. Oh, my God, I've got to go to DMV. Well, you know, because you don't think of it as being enjoyable.
Right.
I just have to find a way of enjoying the process and beating them at their game. But when you're doing food, you know, you want to put the love in it.
Yeah.
I tell you, if you do it with anger or you do it with hostilities, I don't think the food works as well.
Right.
I think our energies poison things.
Yeah.
I don't mean poison for the sake of dead. I mean poison as far as you – it's like being with somebody, you know. If you're,
right.
If you're not courteous with them, if you're – not showing some kind of love or embrace with them, then you're going to pay a price.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely. Okay, so let's tell people again. We're just about out of time. Theo Pinglis, the book is
Seducing Celebrities, One Meal at a Time.
There you go. You know, it's all about seduction, man.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh,
I really
you.
Appreciate it. You're a man with a lot of interesting things to say, a lot of things to learn from. And I salute you for that. You know, it's nice to have you. The world is a better place with you there. You know?
Oh, thank you. It's like someone said to me one day, I'm bored. I said, no, you're boring.
Yeah.
You know, there's too many things out there to be interested in. But
right. What
gets us is fear.
That's true.
It's the fear that camouflages everything else.
Yeah.
We're in fear either of money or jobs or courts or whatever or exams, that is not that kind of camouflages. So you have to go through it.
Yeah,
you know, you don't. If you see a rock in front of you, you don't just try to push it. You try to climb over it.
That's true.
So you know, obstacles are there.
Yeah,
for us to overcome. That's part of our existence.
Yeah, but fear really gets in the way of growing. You know, you don't try things. You know, and you're afraid of failing or whatever it is. And it just overwhelms you, you know.
Yes.
Theo, thank you again so much for
joining us. Thank you.
All the best to you. Good luck with the book. When is the signing again?
It's next Wednesday at 7 o'clock at Barnes & Noble at the Grove.
There you go. And don't miss that. It sounds like
a
great thing. I'll try and come too. In fact, Wednesday nights, I might be available. That's next week, right? Yeah.
Come.
Yeah, I would love to.
Come.
I would love
Bring your to. Wife.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, everybody, thank you all so for joining us, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.